athletes start adopting it because they feel like, oh, if we do this ketogenic diet, we can ramp up the usage of fats for energy, as an energy such as a fuel, and also these ketones. And then now it's hitting the bodybuilding community, right? Ketogenic diets for, you know, getting shredded and all that stuff, increased fat oxidation rates and all that stuff. So I can say that some of it's all misapplied, misunderstood, but that's where sort of the ketone, exogenous ketones came about. You know, can we just supplement the ketones? Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Mike Tussam here with Doug Larson, Anders Varner, and we're hanging out here in Encinitas at Physical Culture 101, one of our favorite places to train. Mm-hmm. And we have Dr. Eddie Joe here. Nice. You're the director of performance at
Cal Poly Pomona.
Cal Poly.
Yeah, Cal Poly Pomona.
And I started following you, I don't know, maybe a year ago, something like that.
Yeah.
Dr. Andy Galpin mm-hmm. had re-Instagrammed a infographic, and I was like, oh, this is fucking brilliant. It was on lactate, and I was like, okay. So I re-grammed that, started following you, mm-hmm. and then I've just really enjoyed everything you put out ever since.
I appreciate it. Yeah,
I'm excited, and I think everyone listening is going to get a lot of information here. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I actually think if you're listening right now and you have your phone with you, which you more likely do, like, go check out his channel and see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You got a bunch of like super cool infographics that really break down like muscle physiology research into like super easy to understand terms, where instead of reading a big long research paper, which of course almost nobody wants to do, you can just get the results right there in a single post.
Yep.
So what's your Instagram handle?
At Dr. Eddie Joe.
At Dr. Eddie Joe.
Dr. Eddie Joe, I believe.
And they're crispy clean. They all look very nice. It's super pro.
Appreciate it.
How
much
money have you invested in those infographics?
Well, if you say time is money, then I put in a lot of money. it does take some time, but it started off just taking like figures from my lectures, my PowerPoint lectures and stuff that I, you know, have from my exercise physiology course. Shout out to my students there. And it's just one student who just said, hey, you know, why don't you post one of these things up? You know, I see some fitness guys on Instagram posting infographics and all that, but they're so generic. I mean, how many ways can you put how many ways can you say you need a caloric deficit? You know, you see tons of those infographics, and so they're like, we need to put something a little bit more sciencey and all that stuff. So they asked me, hey, that lactate study or that lactate lecture that you did today, that was awesome. That figure looks cool. Why don't you go and put it on Instagram? And it took me like a few days, and I was just like, no, I don't have time for that. And so before I posted that one, that first one, it was just a bunch of random shit like in the lab, like, oh, look, we're doing this study. I mean, I had like 200 followers. And so I was like, you know what, I'll just go and put it up. So I cleaned it up, put it into a little box, and then I posted this thing on lactate myths and talk about like some of the common myths associated with lactate and lactate accumulation and fatigue and things of that sort. And it just blew up. And I think Andy, our friend Andy Galpin, I think he reposted it, like you said, and he has, what, like, I don't know how many followers, but, you know, he's borderline insta-famous, I guess, at least relative to people in our field.
For the
PhDs, something to brag about, right?
Galpin's not a butt model, but he's insta-famous.
He's no Brett Contreras, but he's insta-famous. So, he posted it, and just sure enough, man, my phone was blowing up. And so I got all these followers and people liking it, and I was like, holy crap, and then this is interesting. And so I told my student, yeah, this is interesting. I just started getting a bunch of followers, and he said, just keep posting your lecture slides you already created. And so I started doing that, and now I'm like really OCD about it. It has to be all uniform, all perfect, same color schemes and all that. If you take a look at it,
are
it's
you
just
rich
like,
yet?
Oh man, I wish, man. I was like, when is this gonna make me some money? So it's
just
been
keep
great.
Working, yeah. Just keep working for our benefit. I appreciate it.
Right, you know, but. You know, it takes some time, but, you know, it's fun. You know, I feel like this is why we do the research, especially in our field. I mean, we like to publish, and you know, there's some researchers in our field that love to publish, get that number up. I got 50 pubs, I got 60, and they put it up on a pedestal. But for the most part, nobody cares outside the scientific community. Even within the scientific community, it's only like a small group of people.
The other researchers think it's cool.
Yeah, other researchers. Yeah, and so to me, it's like the reason why we're doing this research is to help people. You know, non-scientific community, like the fitness community, sport athletes, coaches, and all that. So, I mean, biomedical researchers do research so that they can pave the way or innovate new treatment modalities that, you know, doctors can use. And so in the same way, if we can't communicate this stuff to people in a way that they can understand, what's the whole point of doing this? So that really started motivating me to do more of these infographics. And, you know, sometimes I mess up and I get a little too sciencey, and I've been writing so many.
It's better than to mess up and just say something that's complete bullshit.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And just sound like an idiot, basically. And you
that's
know, just,
my job.
So, man, it's
that's my corner.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You stay, your lane. Away.
Yeah. Yeah. So, man, it's you know, it was a challenge at first because, you know, I'm so used to writing scientific papers that. Yeah. Writing some of this lay stuff, it's you know, it was starting to be challenging. And so I started, you know, kind of doing a little hybrid, like science / lay language kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, I think people appreciate it, you know, and, you know, people DM me, hey, can you like break it down even further? And I'll just take some time to do it. I don't answer everybody's questions, but, and that's funny when people think, like, they get mad because you don't respond to them right away. I was like, dude, you know, like I said, I'm not making money off of this.
Well, the other thing too is, you know, people assume that everyone's like they are.
Yeah.
Like, just because you live on Instagram doesn't mean I live on Instagram.
Right. So, even though I really do.
Well, as a researcher too, how many times are you getting somebody that's coming across and you've posted something about like lactate or ketones? They're like, no.
I
know. You're like, dude, I'm a doctor. Like, I've gone to school for, I research this stuff.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking that, but I try not to say that. That just makes me sound like a dick. So I just like, I just say, okay. And then I'll just put a random, like random comment or an emoticon of a thumbs up or something. Say, all right, sure.
That's the thumbs up.
Oh man, I did this post on, you guys ever watched that Netflix documentary, What the Health or something?
Oh
my goodness. And so.
Brutal.
Something about like eggs and equivalent to.
I watched the first like 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
And I was like, all right, I got a lot of friends. Yeah. They're saying I should watch this. like half of them are vegan. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch this so that I can have the conversation.
Yeah.
10 minutes in, I'm like, not happening.
Oh man.
It was like, I was like, the entire premise of this entire fucking movie is based on complete and total bullshit.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like just
crazy.
I mean, they mask it in a way where they're, oh, we're using these doctors and these doctors are citing all these papers and stuff, but I actually pulled up all the papers and I'm like, dude, they didn't even interpret this right. And I did a post on that and I got so many trolls, man. This one guy was just going crazy, like started saying some weird shit, like like I'm in my chakra zone right now, you can't defeat me. I was like, whoa, this is fun. So I just kept on responding to the guy. And then it just became really like just comical. And so
you get trolled by a bunch of people that obviously didn't read the same papers that you read.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like you're a one in a million person that's actually gonna go find those papers, read them and know what they say.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that's a huge part of your piece. PhD training is not really to become an expertise in like one like specific field of study, but really just to be an expert at, you know, reading papers, doing the analysis, understanding what that analysis represents, and to scrutinize some of those papers and some of the designs that we see and being able to say, no, you know, I don't think you can make this interpretation from these results. And so I think a lot of the infographics that I kind of have envisioned are basically doing just that. Like, you know, you see this study and it's kind of made some rounds in the popular media, and people are just interpreting it the wrong way. You know,
right.
And so like,
well, that's super, super common.
Oh, so common. Yeah.
People say, I'm like, oh, where's the research? And they post a link to an article.
Oh,
where I go, that actually has nothing to do with what we're
talking
about.
Yeah, and an actual analysis doesn't even come to that conclusion. Even the authors don't come to that conclusion.
Right.
So you see that largely with these, like, you know, hypertrophy training studies, these, like, nutrition studies and ketogenic studies and all that stuff, and people are just going, like, taking off with it. And maybe it's because, you know, industry finds one study, and they're like, we can run with this. We can sell this product or we can sell this. And I get it from that standpoint, but it really perpetuates this problem of, like, kind of like the bro science and just like saying, oh, I it's proven by science, so I'm right. You know, I was like, did you really read the paper? You know, and so a lot of my education training is really just to learning how to not be that guy, you know, and just be able to provide a correct interpretation of these results.
Let's dig in. I want to dig into some of this, I guess, the myths. We're going to dig into the myths.
Yeah.
Before going further, want to mention and thank our sponsors. We have first sponsor being Organifi. They make really great, really great supplements. Green juice, red juice. Mm. They dump a lot of really good mushrooms and adaptogens and all sorts of fun stuff. Maybe we could talk about that. I don't know.
Maybe.
And do you get into the green juice? Do you do any nutrition research specifically?
Yeah, I do. I
Anytime
do quite a bit
someone
of
leads with like the, you're like, oh, we're about to get into a real talk here. Here we go. Green juice. Let's go.
We can talk about that. But
sure.
Just want to mention that. Anyways, we all love Organifi.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Using it.
Yeah,
we do. Check it out. Go over to
really simple solution to getting the things you need in a day.
Simple. Sure. Yeah. Especially. Yeah. Again, I think we say this every time. Not everyone has equal access to organic food and all that kind of stuff. So go get some green juice, some red juice, and some of that plant-based protein. You're gonna get 20% off. Use the code SHRUGGED.
Other sponsor?
Other sponsor.
That would be Thrive Market.
That would be Thrive Market.
Yeah, we went up and hung out with Gunner a little while back and checked out their HQ and got to see like what the company culture was like and really get like a behind the scenes look at that whole organization. Really, really impressive. Like, it seems like they have a very strong mission. They have very high quality products and they're really focused on making sure that everything they sell is like only like the tip top highest quality things and a very convenient way to buy online. If you go to their sites, it's, you know, it's really convenient e-commerce, similar to Costco or to Amazon. Like, you pay a monthly membership, but then the price of everything is very cheap. In our case, we have free shipping available if you want to check it out. Where do people go for?
And you might want to watch your coffee there, Doug.
I get excited sometimes.
I
spill my coffee on the computer.
Yeah, you can.
Anyone listening?
What I like about Thright. Colton behind the camera is like, that's my fucking computer. We got extras. Don't worry about it.
It was just a drop.
Yeah. What I love about Thrive Market is you can just trust that all the ingredients are super high quality, ethically sourced, and isn't going to be full of a bunch of bullshit that's going to make you sick. So if you want to stay healthy, make sure to be shopping there. ThriveMarket.com/shrugged. You'll get $60 worth of free groceries. Free shipping on, was it the first 30 days?
30-day free trial.
And they have an annual membership. That's basically how they make their money. So they're giving you the food as cheap as possible. You have an annual membership, but you'll get that annual membership taken off for the first month. So you can just try it out.
Yeah.
Love it.
Even talking to Gunner, they were saying they basically break even on all of their food products, and all of their profits come from the membership side of things. So everything you're buying from them is basically at cost for whatever it takes for them to get it to you, and then the membership is what pushes their business. So you can't get that quality of food anywhere else.
Yeah, wait. And I said Gunner too. It's Gunnar, right?
Gunnar.
Excuse me.
Sorry about that, bud.
Sorry, Gunnar.
Yeah. He's tuning in for sure.
For sure. Right. He lives on Barbell
Show. For every episode, the second it comes out. If I don't post it right away, you text me.
Yeah. All right. Let's dive into these myths.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. The one that caught my eye, I think, was one of your first ones. The one that Andy regrammed and then I regrammed.
Was
the lactate.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons, a few things. A, I'll walk through the gym. I'll hear a personal trainer say something. I'm like, that's not quite right. And I'm not saying I'm the expert on this. This is one of those things where like I don't really know the whole story, and I'm really interested in hearing it. But I also know what's not the whole story.
Right.
Or the massage therapist is like, I'm going to work your lactic acid out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'm like, you have no idea what's going on.
Oh, and you hear sports commentators all the time, like, oh, that lactic acid. Like I said, it was just an idea brought up by my students. You know, I teach this stuff in my class, and, you know, I implore debate. So if they, if they want to debate it, then I'm all for it, and then we have a healthy conversation about it, and, you know. So I knew it was a hot topic, and I think the reason, like you said, is because you hear it all the time, man. You go to the gym, and I'm not the type. When I go to the gym, I'm just in, you know, in my zone. I don't like pay attention to anybody else, but I do hear it, like personal trainers especially talking about lactate this, lactate that.
So wait, what yeah. specifically does the lay person believe about lactic acid?
Lactate is just bad, right? Lactate is just
the burning sensation.
It's the burning sensation. It's the acute fatigue, like the fatigue you feel when you know, you're running a sprint or doing sprint interval training or wing gates or like CrossFit or whatever. That fatigue, it's not because you're running out of fuel. It's because there's something inhibiting your muscle contraction. That's what we call acute fatigue. And a lot of people attribute that to lactate accumulation. And so here's the thing.
Some people think it makes you sore.
What about lactate, lactic acid? Is that the same thing?
So that's not the same thing, even though it's used synonymously. You know, lactic acid is an acid. It's acidic, where lactate is not. And so lactase anionic, it's actually not an acidic molecule, and that's what we produce through the breakdown of carbohydrates, glucose, glycogen, and glucose 6-phosphate, all that stuff, glycolysis. And, you know, during certain situations, we can't really break down those carbohydrates fully through aerobic systems. And so we're relying on these fast systems, and it kind of slower cutting that carbohydrate breakdown short and ending in lactate. And then there we have lactate accumulation. And so here's the thing. It's like we're talking about correlation. If we get like kind of statistical here, we know like the common thing that people do is they find a correlation between two things, and you know, they say this causes this, but we all know to some extent, like for the most part, that correlations do not establish cause and effect. But here's the thing, the classic finding was that there was a correlation, a tight correlation, a very strong correlation between lactate accumulation and acute fatigue, like the fatigue you feel when you sprint, right? And so immediately the people saw that and they were like, you know what, lactate causes the acute fatigue. Lactate causes the burning sensation and all that stuff, right? But we know that the cause and effect is not established from that correlation. And so, and you know, you see the same thing with like the whole Netflix, what the hell thing we talked about. They're talking about all these correlations and they're applying cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect.
So wait, if you did an Aerodyne sprint, you did like a 1 minute sprint as hard as you could. You get very, very tired by the end of that. They draw your blood and they say, well, your lactate went up really, really high. So therefore lactate, the researchers didn't say this, but like people think when they see this,
right.
Therefore since lactate went up, that's what made you tired.
Exactly.
But if they tested tested hundreds of other things, probably some other things would be going up as well.
Right.
But they only test this one thing example, so that's what they attribute it to.
Your heart rate goes up, your muscle blood flow goes up, so there's a correlation between fatigue and your muscle blood flow going up. So is that what's causing the fatigue? No, it's not, right? And so
it's mostly heart rate.
Yeah, so they wanted to attribute to lactate and lactate accumulation. And so what we found was that, you know, it's not, yes, there is a correlation, but there is no cause and effect there. Okay, and so we like, dig deeper into what's causing this acute fatigue effect, and it has everything to do with pH, the acidity. And so cells can only function as enzymes that run the cell, metabolism of the cells, the pathways that produce ATP, which is our cell's energy currency for like contraction in the case of a muscle cell, that all needs to be working fine so that you have full functional capacity of your muscles. But during these high intensity max effort exercises, something is inhibiting that. And so that is really because the acidic nature that is kind of brought upon about these types of muscle activities, these high intensity activities. And so, you know, with that drop in pH and increase in acidity, you have things like fatigue and inhibition of muscle functionality. You have things like pain, or we call it the burning sensation and all that stuff. And the thing is, people thought, well, we see this correlation between lactate accumulation and those effects. And so lactate is causing that drop in pH, causing that acidity. But the more and more we research it, we're like, well, it's not actually. And so we studied lactate first, and we're like, well, lactate, about 75 to 80% of that is actually reused. Like I said, it's just carb breakdown that is cut short. So it has potential energy within that molecule. We can process it even more and get more ATP produced from it. So
lactate's
it's a fuel.
Lactate.
Lactate is a usable fuel source, especially for type 1 fibers and cardiac muscle cells.
Yeah. That's called the Cori cycle?
The part of the lactate shuttle system, right? And so, lactate does it clear, not for the purpose of relieving the burning sensation and relieving fatigue effects, but it's because it circulates. It's a fuel source that different tissues in the body can use, right?
So having lactate is a good thing.
Oh, yeah, and they try to make lactate supplements, but because of the negative connotation associated with lactate, it just didn't work, right?
Would that be like pyruvate and things like that?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, if they thought, well, if you supplement, a lot of things in the supplement industry, if you supplement like something that, like a fuel source, something that could support ATP production, well, that could have some performance benefits. So they saw this, like scientists saw, well, lactate is a fuel source. Why not? Why can't we turn it into a supplement? Mm. So, you know, there's some mixed research on that, but it just, you know, there's no point in continuing doing this research because the industry has already made their mind up about lactate, and the industry is driven by, you know, the people's interests, and they're like, no, lactate's bad, right?
People's interests. Yeah, and so not always right. on point.
Yeah.
So what's the difference right. between lactate? Lactate is used as a fuel. It's basically something that didn't get all the way used, like a carbohydrate.
Right. Exactly.
Didn't
yeah.
get all the way used, mm-hmm. and now it's going to recirculate for fuel for.
Right, for more ATP production.
Yep.
Right, and that could fuel muscles and some other tissues, and a quarter of that lactate is recycled to form more glucose in the liver. Mm. Right, so it's your body doesn't like to waste things that are valuable, especially something that's dense with energy, and so we're reusing that and recycling it. Right, so people think it just disappears or just gets cleared, and you ask them, well, where does it get cleared to? And they're like, oh no, it just gets cleared. Right, and so right, and so it's actually ether. Reused. Right, and so. So what's causing this acidity? And so we take a look at it, and it's really because you're using ATP in your muscle cells during high activities, or high muscular activities, like during high intensity and max effort exercise. You're breaking down these ATPs through a process called ATP hydrolysis at a very, very fast rate. And through that process, you're actually releasing these acidic protons, which is positively charged hydrogen ions. And, you know, the pH will drop if the protons start to accumulate. And that's really where that acute fatigue mechanism is sort of based on, is that proton accumulation. So that's why when we work out really hard and then we're doing high intensity exercise sprints and things of that sort, that's why we feel those effects.
Too many protons.
Yeah, too many protons, man. And that's it right there. And
I want to hear the personal trainer say that.
Yeah, too many protons, right?
Too many protons,
yeah.
bro.
Yeah, I don't recommend you ever using that explanation with your general client. But
like, what does that mean? And yeah, then they're so like, oh, I actually don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I heard it on Barbell Shrug.
You should go follow this Instagram account real quick.
Yeah, and so during these types of environments, high-intensity environments, there's a lot of things contributing to that other than the rapid ATP breakdown. And so we have this acute fatigue, and the beauty of nature is, why do we have this acute fatigue process? Why do we have situations where something is inhibiting us from continuing to engage in that high muscle activity? Yeah. And you have to think about it. It's a protective mechanism, because when you're exercising above your anaerobic threshold, like doing max effort sprints, your CrossFits and all that stuff, it's a metabolically stressful environment. And what I mean by that is that you're lowering that pH, you're creating this acidic environment, which is damaging to cells. And so as a protective mechanism, your body tries to stop the stress that is causing that, right? So it's like a biological stop signal. And the burning sensation is the same thing. We think about pain. What is pain from a biological standpoint? It's a protective mechanism.
It's a message.
Right? Yeah, it's a message telling you, and we don't like pain, and there's a reason why we don't like pain, at least for most people. Yeah. I don't know if some people are into that stuff, but you know, right?
This audience,
depends on what night of the week it is.
right. So there's a reason why we don't like pain. It's because we don't want to keep doing what's causing that pain, right? And so we have all these signals telling us to stop because this is stressful. And so somewhere along the lines, we just attributed all that to lactate. And so I wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
That lactate is not the culprit. It's not a negative thing. It's something that your body naturally produces, especially during high to max effort exercise, and we like to reuse it. We're not going to waste it, and that's not what's causing us to fatigue and to feel that burning sensation. And so I put that out there, and then another thing was like lactate causes soreness and all that stuff, DOMS and all that stuff. And that, just from a scientific perspective, makes absolutely no sense, you know? And so I don't know where that came from.
I love it.
I don't know where that came from. And so
I think people think, yeah. Okay, I feel this burning sensation, right. And that must cause me to get sore. Like there's some intuitiveness to that. Like, okay, it hurts right now, and so it's going to hurt later because it hurts right now.
Right. I think that's a very –
like it burns my muscle.
The muscle's burning due to the
drop in pH, yep. the acidification, and you know, those are triggering these sensory neurons. That's pretty much that signal is being registered as pain. You know, protective mechanism. Stop what you're doing because it's stressful.
So what's that have to do with muscle soreness?
Very little, man. I mean, I think, you know, I guess it's a little bit of general intuition where you think, oh, my muscle's burning. So that might be what's causing the soreness a couple days later. Kind of like if you like burn like skin and then it's going to hurt, right? It's not really necessarily connected. It may be indirectly connected. So, you know, kind of going with the whole topic of soreness, you know, we call it delayed onset muscle soreness and all that. And I would say there's a large amount of people, especially in the fitness community and, you know, your massage therapist and, you know, maybe even some medical practitioners that would say, oh, it's just a lactate buildup, right? Not to say that's like the 100, not to say that they're saying that that's, you know, 100% what's causing it, but they'll say something like that, right? Lactate buildup and, you know, like, you know, TV sports commentators will say, yeah, they didn't get to clear that lactate or something like that, right? And so, and we hear it all the time. And so the soreness really is not caused by lactate accumulating in that area. I mean, lactate is going to be used by the body. It's going to circulate. And hypothetically, even if it did get trapped or accumulated in that area, it wouldn't have anything to do with triggering that pain, that soreness, right? And so what's causing this soreness here? And so you have to understand that when muscles become damaged, like physically damaged because you're doing high tension exercise, you're causing tears, just like when you cut your skin, you know? And so there's going to be a response to that, right? An immune response to clean it up and heal it.
So wait, why does the pain come maybe 2 days later instead of just like right away?
Oh,
why?
Yeah. Right.
And like so, why is it delayed
like
onset muscle soreness instead of just
Friday than right. Thursday?
And yeah, yeah. Right. And
like sometimes you wake up the next day and you're like, oh, wow, I didn't get very sore at all. And then the next day you're like, God, I'm so sore. Like, why is there a delay?
Right. And I get that question all the time. And it's really directly related to the severity of damage. So when you have severe damage, meaning like you tore your muscles, right, you feel it right away as opposed to just doing heavy exercise and maybe undergoing some minor damage, you feel it a couple days later, right? So it has to do with that acute inflammatory response, as I talked about earlier. And so with this acute inflammatory response, you're releasing some of these molecules. These are what are called pro-inflammatory molecules, and they start to trigger all these different things. Like I said, primary is going to start the healing process, cleaning up the area, start the healing process, but it can interact with sensory neurons. And these sensory nerves basically send information from the muscle area to the central nervous system, and then we register it as something, right? A sensation, perhaps. And so these pro-inflammatory molecules that are released can interact with those sensory neurons to tell us that, you know, or to send a signal to the brain saying, and the brain registers it as pain, soreness, right? And sometimes that takes time, right? And so, yeah, a couple days later, you might feel soreness, but that's really because the process of healing, that inflammatory response, is just starting, right? And so when you have more severe damage, then, you know that's instantaneous, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Are anti-inflammatories killing the feedback loop?
It could blunt that response, right? So that's why a lot of people kind of resort to, you know, anti-inflammatory drugs and things of that sort to minimize that soreness effect. And so it's just that pathway that you're sort of blocking there. But like we said before, what implications does that have to the healing process? And so we don't know. There's some hints that show that it might blunt the healing process.
Yeah, because I've had a lot of people say, hey, take anti-inflammatories right after you train. Yeah. And I've actually had conversations with people who they're more from the marketing department of a supplement company. And they're like, this is good for this. I'm like, I'm not like a PhD, but I also am not
stupid.
Like, I'm not an idiot.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not, I've tried to explain to people, I was like, I actually think some inflammation after training can be a really good thing. And I'm not sure. And I don't know. And I know you don't know.
Right.
You're just repeating what you were told.
Well, it's certainly not just about inflammation as well. Like a lot of times I've seen research that says if you take ibuprofen post-training, it can inhibit muscle recovery, but at the same time, post-workout shakes, especially post-workout carbohydrate ingestion, it's also anti-inflammatory, which isn't why most people take it, but if carbohydrates are anti-inflammatory post-workout, but that tends to increase performance, recovery, future muscle mass, but NSAIDs, ibuprofen, naproxen, whatever, they tend to decrease muscle recovery.
Right.
Then it can't just be about inflammation. If one hurts muscle recovery and it's anti-inflammatory, and one helps muscle recovery and it's also anti-inflammatory, there's more to the story there.
Of course, and there's a host of pathways that are there, and we just have to figure out ways to test it and discover it and measure it, right? And so, you know, I think the research is
is catching up, and so it's kind of releasing more information so that we have a better understanding of what's going on. But you know, going back to the whole lactate thing, that myth has died a long time ago, but it's still being talked about.
Not in everybody's mind.
In everybody's mind, but you know, at least from the scientific community, you know, there's no connection there, you know, and so we just always have to think of soreness. That's pain. That's sensory information, right? So what's triggering those nerves? And so we see these nerves at the end of these nerves. There's these receptors called nociceptors, and they have all these channels that are sensitive to little things, right? One is sensitive to pH. When pH levels drop, it triggers it. When you have inflammation, those inflammatory molecules can trigger it. When you have free radicals that are released, which is natural part of the healing process, right? It triggers it, right? So you have all these things triggering this soreness. And again, from the biological standpoint, why do we have soreness? What is this? We don't really think about it. We just know it's there and it's not very pleasing, right? But again, from a biological standpoint, it's just, hey, let's not mess with this part of my body for now while I'm trying to heal it, right? Yeah. Let's not continue to damage it, right? But I think we're so caught up on just like trying to stop that soreness or inhibit that soreness, and we don't know what's happening to that whole healing process, right?
You may be doing something good. You may not be. You may be doing something that's going to slow down your progress long term.
Right. And you can use, like, say, again, going back to skin physiology, you can put a cream on there that might help reduce the pain, but it's not like facilitating or speeding up the actual recovery, the healing of the tissue, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably at the same rate or maybe even slowing down. Who knows? But you know, the thing is, muscles, you know, we can't, like, open up our skin and see what's going on.
Well, anytime I'm interrupting a feedback loop, I see that as a potential danger.
Right, you know, and, you know, when I say, like, so what do you think? What's the best recovery tool? And people hate it when I say this because it's not fancy. And it's like, no one has ever in history argued against good old-fashioned rest and proper nutritional intake. No one will argue that, but
so
it's boring, right?
It's
so boring, right? Given your muscles rest, not stressing it, you know, and causing more damage, and giving some building blocks so that it can rebuild. And
but
so,
I want results now.
Yeah. People hate that, right? And so they want, what's the latest supplement I can take? What's the latest technique I can do? And, you know, it's just, but there's so much debate around those things, but there's never a lot of debate on resting, right?
I love that you compare all of that to, like, getting a sunburn. Because if you, like, rub aloe on a sunburn, I always wonder, like, how much is this really speeding up this process? Is it a day?
Mm-hmm.
Like an hour?
Mm-hmm.
Do I feel pain in 20 minutes less? Or, like, what's really going on? And
it all depends on if a hot chick is putting it on. That's been my experience.
Well, that's the down regulation piece.
Yeah, there you go.
It's an up-regulation.
You know. You can learn a lot about muscle physiology and muscle recovery and all that stuff just by observing your skin when it's damaged, because, you know, it undergoes damage all the time. And I use it as an example in my classes all the time, and it clicks with the students. Like, what makes it different for muscle? It's not like some kind of super special cell that's going to respond differently, right? And so, you know, in terms of damage and healing, it's really the same process for any cell. So we got to kind of observe that and just sort of figure, well, you know, there's further questions that we need to ask about muscle recovery. Is all the stuff that's out there that's supposed to enhance muscle recovery, is it actually facilitating that healing process, or is it just slowing it down? And so I want to look at the long-term effects here. I want to see, like, the physical characteristics of the muscle with someone taking some anti-inflammatory drugs or some type of anti-inflammatory agent compared to, say, like a placebo control or something like that. And just see what's going on. Put them through like a 12-week training program, hardcore training program, and just see what's going on with their muscles, right? Is it actually slowing down healing? Is it slowing down adaptation? We just have to figure that out.
Where are you going to find people to participate for 12 weeks?
Yeah, if you're not paying them, right, it's really hard. But
get a free training program.
Yeah, you know, I try to sell it that way. Do a free body comp scan, DEXA scan or something like that. And they usually, all right, let's do it.
Oh, yeah, we did a lot of that when we were in school. It was like, you know, some studies paid, some didn't. But I was getting a lot of data on my own body the whole time. I feel like that was like the most valuable thing. One of the most valuable things I got by going to school was just participating in the studies,
right,
being a lab rat, and then just asking a lot of questions while I was there, like what are we looking at, why, what's the hypothesis?
This
is great.
Yeah,
and sometimes you get like $100 in college. You're like, that's like a 25% bump in my income.
Groceries.
That's funny you said that. I
drove 500 miles for $100 $100 study.
That's funny you say that, because we did a study not too long ago, and then it was a training study, like 8 weeks or something like that, and the sponsors for the study were funding the study that they didn't budget in compensation. And then I was like, you know, we're not getting a lot of subjects for this, not a lot of interest. And so they said, okay, we'll say we'll pay each subject $100. As soon as I put that out there, so many emails.
Yeah, all college kids students, will do right? anything for $100. Yeah. I used to like give blood for like $50 a week.
Oh, yeah.
This right. was important stuff. This was the only source of income.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Were they what was it, the plasma?
Yeah, that was the
oh
one.
Yeah, my yeah. God.
It was like an hour, I get my studying in all at the same time.
Yep.
Or yeah. you give like a pint?
I don't know what it was. They just told me they like got a whole $50. I would have done anything.
Well, they got like just take as much as you want.
Yeah, they'd have to recycle the whole thing. I don't.
This explains it's 50 so bucks. Much.
I'll make more. Yeah.
Right. Who knows what they were putting back in?
Right. Let's take a break. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about ketones because that's a all hot right. topic right now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Thanks for watching the show. If you'd like to learn more about how to improve your snatch, clean, and jerk, we have a free 55-page ebook you can get at flightweightlifting.com. It has sample programming specifically for weightlifting, weightlifting how-to technique videos, and other tips on how to improve all of your lifts. Go to flightweightlifting.com, and you can download that ebook for free.
Download it now.
All right, and we're back with Dr. Eddie Joe talking about science
yes, sir.
Of muscle, physiology, exercise, all that stuff.
All that stuff.
You're like a genius when it comes to this. Yeah. I love it. And, you know, we just covered delayed onset muscle soreness, DOMS. Mm-hmm. We covered the, lactate myths. Mm-hmm. That shit's not trapped in your body. long story short. And now I want to find out about ketones because yeah. that's all the rage right now. I mean, I've been taking them here and there.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interest in ketone supplementation, exogenous ketones, if you want to get fancy with terms and all that. So, yeah.
I want to talk about exogenous ketones. And then mm-hmm. also, is it butyric acid? Does that cause your liver to create more ketones as well?
So in terms of ketogenesis, like naturally producing ketones within the body, so endogenously, that usually happens when you're carb depleted. And so we have different cells in our body, like brain cells, that you need carb, like glucose, right, to as fuel. Mm-hmm. So it can, you know, generate the ATP needed to run and all that stuff. And so the thing is, when we're carb depleted, like we're glycogen depleted, our cells are depleted, that like our liver cells, and we don't have, we need to just keep maintaining that glucose levels. Now we need to start utilizing other fuel sources, so like fats, right? We start ramping up fat oxidation, breaking down fat, so they can we can release some energy and all that. So during that process, we start to also produce ketones. So it's part of that fat metabolism pathway where some of it goes into ketogenesis, and we produce these ketone bodies, and we have three specific ones. And so the reason why we
three
do
different
that,
types yeah, of ketone bodies?
Endogenously, yeah, inside okay. our body. And so the thing is, the reason why we do that is because our brain can only utilize glucose or ketones. It can't utilize fats. And so that's just kind of one way that our body sort of innately sort of responds to this carb depleted state so that we can have brain food, right? And so
I've heard that ketones are better for energy for the brain than glucose.
Yeah, there's some argument there. That's kind of where the whole idea of the ketogenic diet sort of was born, you know, to help release the risk of seizures and things of that sort. And actually, I think it was actually started when I think it was like Navy SEALs or something like that. They're using these rebreathers that when they scuba dive because they can't create bubbles and all that stuff. And there was like a high prevalence of seizures with these military soldiers. And so, you know, this
great.
This
physician. Seizures yeah. underwater
right,
while you're
right,
scuba
exactly.
diving.
Yeah. So they started coming up with, well, how can we,
sounds
maybe
like a
it's,
problem.
Maybe the brain is getting out. Depleted of energy substrate fuel, right? And so they thought of this ketogenic diet to look to see if ketones
like
can
that's the concern
it, so,
that came yeah. out of all that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of, you know, you get one thing, we see, oh, wow, this is great. And then, you know, the athletes start adopting it because they feel like, oh, if we do this ketogenic diet, we can ramp up the usage of fats for energy as an energy source, as a fuel, and also these ketones. And then now it's hitting the bodybuilding community, right? Ketogenic diets for, you know, getting shredded and all that stuff, increased fat oxidation rates and all that stuff. So I can say that some of it's all misapplied, misunderstood, but that's where sort of the ketone, exogenous ketones came about. You know, can we just supplement the ketones?
Yeah, I want to rewind real quick. you said there was three different types of ketones your body produces. And what's
so the main one, so they're not a whole lot of difference. The main one is beta hydroxymethylbutyrate. So that's the one that typically we would consume as a, you know, as
it's
a
Andrew's
supplement.
Favorite one.
Yeah, of course. I have some of those.
So we would use this ketone exogenously. And so the whole idea behind that is that can we just provide an alternative fuel source for our muscles to utilize? Because our muscles can also utilize ketones. And so that's kind of like the premise of a lot of these ergogenic supplements like creatine and all that stuff to provide more support for ATP production. You know, if we can provide more more of this fuel source, could we actually enhance performance?
So if if I'm not ketogenic, if I'm not if I'm still eating carbs and I'm relying on glucose for fuel, introducing exogenous ketones, there could be a benefit.
Right. And so we're starting to see some.
But it may not be fat burning benefit.
No.
So like a cognition benefit?
Perhaps. And so you know, it's sort of kind of a new area of research right now. And I think, you know, of course, when industry finds out about like a research study that shows, oh, this exogenous supplement seems to have these benefits in terms of performance, they'll take that one study and try to run with it, right? And so we don't have a huge body of research looking at exogenous ketones. There's not a lot of research on it, but some of the research, they're comprehensive enough to get our minds thinking like, this might be worth looking into, right? And so it makes sense, logically speaking, if we can introduce an alternative fuel source, what kind of benefits would it have in terms of muscle physiology, muscle bioenergetics, and performance, right? We can have an alternative fuel source. We can help preserve muscle glycogen, which is a primary fuel for your muscles during exercise. And could that translate to overall increase in performance capacity? So these are the questions that we have. And so that kind of led to my recent study, looking at just 1 week of ketone supplementation and see how that what does that do in terms of performance in athletes. And so we're currently collecting data on that.
So some supplements like creatine as an example, you can supplement with exogenous creatine, or you can get it naturally through, like you eat a steak, you get some creatine along with the steak. Is it like that for ketones as well? Like do you naturally produce them if you're in ketosis, but do you get exogenous ketones in any natural food sources?
Not really. Yeah. So ketones is it's really hard to get, you know, I'm not even 100% sure on this, but I think it is pretty difficult to get through just regular foods. And so it's something that is mostly produced endogenously, especially in the liver. And so, you know, we figured out a way to turn it into a supplement, and we want to see what that does.
Yeah, right? I may be saying the wrong thing here, but is it butyric acid that would help? Like, so if you're already a little bit carb depleted, is there anything like butyric acid you could take that would cause the liver to produce more ketones? Or am I thinking of something different?
Yeah, I think, not to my knowledge. I think it's really where we find this ramped up ketogenesis, this formation of ketones is just really when you're carb depleted. So you're on like a high fat, low carb or zero carb diet kind of thing. You know, that's going to ramp up the fat oxidation rate. And as a result, that you're going to produce these ketones. And so, yeah, that's one easy way to ramp up your ketone production within your body.
So exogenous ketones could help with performance and cognition and potentially muscle.
Potentially
muscle. I've noticed, I've taken them and noticed some benefit. I wouldn't say it was earth shattering. There's other things that have been earth shattering by comparison. Nothing legal. And the banned substances are the best, really. Let's just be real.
Yeah.
But a lot of people think they're going to take exogenous ketones and burn more fat, and you're saying that's not the case. So it may improve performance, but if you want to burn fat, you actually have to pull the carbs out of your diet.
Right. You have to stay on a – the thing is, from a performance standpoint, we look at ketogenic diets, and there's so much the results are so mixed, right? I think it's safe to say at this point that, you know, it might not be worth it. I mean, we're not getting some significant benefits, especially endurance athletes, from a ketogenic diet. And it largely has to do with the fact that you're carb depleted. In order for you to ramp up the ketogenesis, you have to deplete your cells of carbs, and that's going to affect your muscle glycogen levels, and that's going to affect performance, right? So it's like, you know, maybe that's what's explaining these mixed results. And so this is kind of where ketones come in, exogenous ketones. Well, instead of doing it through a nutritional route, why not we just keep a balanced diet, a good diet that's known to help like these endurance athletes and just take more of the ketones in through a supplement, would that have a benefit? And so that's sort of like the focus right now to see, does that even work? Right?
Didn't a lot of this stuff come out of kind of the medical community and a lot of cancer research, and now it's being applied to the performance side of things?
Yeah, it's kind of funny how that works, right? We sort of start in one area, and it's sort of like there's maybe a couple sciences. I wonder what that how that works in, say, the performance area or the body composition area. And
so many sports are played where in this like anabolic zone where carbohydrates are needed for recovery, and now we've got a bunch of athletes like CrossFitters that are out there not eating carbohydrates, trying to run on 200 grams of fat a day, and it gets
right. It's all in context. You know, you would say like, it's good to have some carbs in your diet, so essentially to refill your muscles, right, with glycogen, because you're utilizing it, right? And so, I mean, I would say it's an important part of your diet, at least for someone who's who's performing at high levels and all that. But then someone will come and say, well, wait, high carb diet. Well, doesn't that make you fat and all that stuff? Some BS like that. I'm like, where did that come from? Right. I'm talking about performance here. And now you're just taking all that information out of content. That happens a lot. Right. And so, you know, just to kind of zone in on like, what are we actually talking about here? Are we talking about performance? Are we talking about body composition? Are we talking about the like medicine? What are we talking about here? So, yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the ketone supplement, right now we're strictly focused on its performance benefits. And so, I mean, we don't know how that works in terms of body composition and physique and all that stuff.
May get shredded too. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? We just have to put it to the test. So, yeah, it's a very new area of research that I'm very interested in. And it just all started with me just reading a paper. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting, you know? And so we took a paper and then we're like, you know what? I think I see some flaws in there, which all papers have. And I feel like I can make it better. And so we designed a new study, very similar, and then we just want to see what the performance outcomes are. We skipped all the other stuff. We're not doing any kind of, tissue analysis and all that. We just want to see, do you perform better after a week of ketone supplementation on a balanced diet? And that's all we wanted to see. And so that's sort of our preliminary study. If we find something cool, then we'll start digging in deeper, right? And so kind of look forward to more ketone research coming out. It's funny how industry works, though. It's like, you start selling right all now. This stuff and it's hot. And when I do consulting with like the supplement industry, it's like, what about ketones? What about ketones? And I show them like the limited body of research that may show some benefits, and that's all they need, right?
I only need one study,
right?
And I will change my whole life.
Right. So that's just how it's been, right? And it's so backwards here. It's like in terms of sports supplementation, you start selling stuff based off of like maybe one or two studies, and then the research catches up, right? And then eventually things stop coming, get off the shelves. They stop selling it because the research catches up. So hopefully, you know, I don't know. I mean, I take an unbiased approach. I just want to see, you know. And so for now, I'm pretty sure the ketone supplement industry will keep ramping up and people will take a look at it and try it. And you know,
we'll see. What supplements have you seen that are just, they've got a ton of evidence that they work but aren't being used?
Right. So the funny thing is we all know that there's like creatine has sort of stood the test of time, right? Creatine monohydrate, and you know, generally speaking, there's about like 70% of the literature out there on creatine as it relates to performance showing some type of positive effect, albeit small, but there's some positive effects. And for some athletes who are competing with other athletes that are almost, from a performance capacity standpoint, almost the same, I mean, they're looking for that edge, right? And so, you know, to me, it's like there's a reason why creatine has stood the test of time, you know, because there's more and more research that shows its benefits even outside of performance. And so we see that creatine is always sort of a staple in the sports supplement industry. And, you know, I don't ever advocate for any supplements. I don't say take this, because it is a supplement. You'd be surprised when someone asked me about creatine or any supplement. And my question to them in return is, well, how do you train? How do you eat? And they go, you know, I hit the gym like 3 times a week and, you know, not giving any description of what their training looks like. And then, you know, I walk
around in circles.
Yeah.
Mostly
yeah. I go do some weights. I lift and then I, you know, eat a balanced diet. And I'm like, okay, so obviously you don't have a training program or a dietary program, which kind of goes together. And so I was like, that's the main question. So that's the main question you need to first ask, not what supplement. But in any case, in terms of supplement, if you're, you know, you got your training program, you got your dietary program, and you're looking for that little edge. I find myself always advocating for creatine, you know,
okay,
just because of research. There's a large body of research that support it. And I want to go that route. I don't want to just say, oh, this one study, which a lot of people do, right? This one study shows this supplement to work, so you should take it, right? And, you know, they might even take that study out of context and apply it the wrong way. But I want to look at the body of research that point towards the same conclusion. And that builds confidence for me to say, yeah, it might work for you.
When you mention a balanced diet when you're doing these things, you've mentioned a couple times, what are you looking for in that to actually use that as kind of the control,
right?
And then what you're testing.
So the balanced diet, I mean, that's such a generalized term, but I know everybody uses it, but, you know, diet is relative to the individual and what they want to do, right? So in any case, I never advocate for being depleted or neglecting any one of those macronutrients, right? I just don't believe in that. And so, you know, for me, is balance is not neglecting any of the nutrients, right? And so you can go high protein, like, you know, maybe 20% carbs are your caloric intake and the rest of the fats, or you can go like, you know, lower protein, moderate fat, and moderate carbs, like all balanced out like that. But as long as you're not neglecting any of those and you're taking in those nutrients, because your body's going to use it, you know, it's good stuff for your body. Your body wants to have those things and use it.
So in your experiments, you're adding the ketones to a balanced diet where there are already carbohydrates present.
Right.
So you don't have to add the stuff into a fasted state.
Exactly. And so we want to see, we do dietary records and see what their diet looks like, right?
Yeah.
We take a good record of it. And so if anyone's going on a ketogenic diet already, they're not going to be eligible for the study. That could totally confound the results, obviously. So we look for certain things. And so we want to make sure, the most part, that this is the diet that they've been going on for a very long time. And then we want them to maintain that, because we don't want to change their diet, because your body's going to respond immediately to a change in that diet. If all of a sudden they stop eating carbs, then your body's going to go under some type of stress to respond to that, right? And so we try to maintain that diet. We're trying to make sure we record it and document it. And, you know, that's hard in itself, but you know, anytime we see anybody, say within a 1 week period, always send one day they just didn't eat anything and they never do that, then we have to drop them from the study, because that could affect the outcomes, right? So yeah, there's a lot, obviously, that goes into these type of supplemental research, a lot of control, and there's always limitations, man. And someone could always like point that out. Like, you know, I'll post a study that I did, and then someone will like point out a limitation that's a limitation in every single study. And I'm like, oh, really? You know, so how would you suggest we control for that? And then they wouldn't really have an answer to that. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's tough, but, you know, we do our best we can. So that's why we have to look at like a body of research that points towards the same conclusion, not like just one single study. Because that single study may just be limited to just males, but females might respond differently. Or someone who has, you know, high carb diet, someone, you know, how does that really work for someone who's on a carb depleted diet, you know? And so, you know, we can't extrapolate everything from one study. So we just got to be careful. But I think as people in general, we're just impatient. We just want something.
Totally.
You know, yeah. So
want the edge.
Yeah.
How many studies, or how do you define, you know, that there's this body of research to support something?
Is that's
100 sort of studies, 1,000 studies. Yeah. Is there, you know, a meta-analysis?
Right. That's, you know, meta-analysis. I'm glad that you brought that up. A meta-analysis is a good way to kind of see what the research says. And it's just like, we just hope that we have people that like doing that kind of stuff, right? Doing statistics and all that, looking at all the papers. So I do actually rely on meta-analysis quite a bit and review papers and things of that sort. I want someone else to like look at all the research and tell me what's going on.
Can you explain to viewers what that is?
A meta-analysis is basically sort of another secondary analysis on data that's already been published, right? So you take like a study and you take their data, their results, you document it, you record it, and say to a spreadsheet, and then you get another study that kind of looked at the same thing. You have some criteria. You have to reject some studies, you can include some studies, and you compile all these results, say for like one measure, like performance, some performance measure, right? And then you do a secondary analysis on those numbers and see, is there an effect? Is there an actual practical effect? Does it translate to actual performance in real life? And sometimes we see all these studies that say, oh, a significant improvement in performance, a significant improvement in performance. But that's a statistical term. Does it actually matter in real life? And so these meta-analyses really help us kind of get this insight. Like, what does it mean practically? Is it practically relevant? Does it mean that we're going to get faster adaptations? Does it mean we're going to beat out the next guy? And so these meta-analyses are helpful in that regard, at least in the context of, you know, this topic. And so You know, there is really no number. We can't say 1,000 studies, that's it. There really is no like actual number that we decided, well, hey, this is enough to say that, you know, this works, right? So we sort of have to kind of just see it, like we sort of backtrack it and we just kind of look up all these research studies that sort of investigated the same thing. And if we're seeing like consistent results and, you know, over time, like 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, as they're researching these and we see consistent outcomes, then you can sort of start thinking like, you know what, I think this is something that could be applied and this is something that could possibly benefit athletes. And so, yeah, I think... even scientists are guilty of just taking one study and getting really excited, especially if it's their own study, you know. Classic case, HMB, you know, like, remember that craze? Like, we get one person, like, getting all these phenomenal results with it, and then they're just a huge advocate of it. They promote it, and the industry wants to partner with it, and they sell it and all that stuff, and, you know, that's
they say, you know, they have a supplement company.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's like, you know, I think even scientists need to be careful, you know, like, you know, it's just one study. Let's just keep let's just keep expanding if you're interested enough. And that's sort of what I'm doing. You know, I'm not really discounting its effects or advocating its effects. I just want to see what's going on, you know, so that I can share and make an infographic, share with the public and tell them like, hey, look, you know, it seems like we have a decent body of research that shows this. Yeah. And actually tell them how many research studies have been done, you know? Yeah.
And I've taken supplements that have a ton of research to back it up, and I'm like, I really don't notice much.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll take some supplements that don't have much research to back it up and feel amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think everybody, in addition to that, just need to be paying attention to what's happening with themselves.
Sure. And we have to keep into account, like, anecdotes, right? You know, I never am a guy that says, no, it's all about science, all about science. Well, if someone feels good, I mean, who am I to say? And it's not harmful to their body. I'm like, who am I to say, like, oh, yeah, this is useless. It's bad because this one or two couple of research studies said it's not going to do anything, right? And so, you know, I don't bother anybody who wants to take these, like, polyphenols or these antioxidant supplements and all that stuff that may not have a lot of research backing, but they feel good. I mean, a placebo effect's a real thing, right? Yeah. And so, you know, like...
It's probably the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, really. So as long as they feel good, I mean, and it's not harmful, like I said, then
go for it.
Yeah. Yeah, spend your money.
Well, for many of these things as well, there's not just going to be one thing that something does. Like, if you say that eating a steak is going to help you build muscle mass, and then you see a paper that says that eating steak doesn't help you improve muscle mass, that doesn't automatically mean that steak is now bad for you and completely worthless.
Yeah,
there's other things that eating a steak might potentially do for you from nourishing all the other tissues of your body that you're not really thinking about, from your skin to your nails to your eyes or whatever else. So just because you're siloing one benefit and that benefit didn't come through doesn't mean that something is worthless.
Right. And it's really important, even as scientists and just consumers, we got to be open-minded. We can't just be so narrow-minded. And I think that happens a lot in sport and fitness, where we get so focused on just like, what's the effects on muscle, right?
Right.
What's the effect on performance, where we don't really look at, I mean, our whole body is made up of multiple organs that are integrated, that communicate with one another, work together. So we kind of have to look at our body from a more holistic approach. And so, you know, yeah, I'm guilty of that too. I get so fascinated by its effects on this one organ system, like muscle, and I just like focus, and I kind of neglect, well, what about all the other tissues and cells in the body, right? What's happening there? What's happening to overall body metabolism, not just metabolism in the muscle? And so, you know, I think it's really important for us to recognize that and just be more open-minded and do more integrative biology, integrative physiology, as opposed to just looking at one organ system, you know. Yeah. But at the end of the day, people want to know, at least in this community, people want to know, does it make me faster? Does it make me stronger? Does it make me, you know, jump or whatever, you know, perform better? And so I like to do a lot of studies that just kind of measure that, you know. Sometimes people don't care what happens in the cells, you know, and so... I agree with that to some extent. What just happens with the whole body, you know? And so, So simple measures are sometimes, I mean, I'm a simpleton. I like having these simple measures and just, you know, people could actually read the paper and understand what we measured, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just the abstract.
Yeah, the abstract.
Sorry. Learned abstract and I'm out.
Right, I'm not reading abstracts anymore. I got infographics.
Right?
Abstracts are so long and they're wordy. Two, three paragraphs at a time.
Yeah,
I ain't got time for that.
Yeah. That is what's so good about those.
Yeah.
A goes to B. Got it.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Right.
Actually, I would say one of the most valuable, as a fitness professional now, one of the most valuable classes I ever took in college was research methods.
Yeah.
And that was just learning how to fucking read a research paper and what it actually means. Mm-hmm. People point out research, and I was like, did you look at the methods? Because what you're trying to apply this to doesn't match that at all. You know, and that's just typical. So,
yeah, and that's it.
I would encourage people to take a research methods class if you can.
Right. And, I mean, there's plenty
of just watch your infographics.
Yeah. Just watch my infographic. I'll take care of it for you, right? Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That's the thing, man. It's, most people don't read these papers. And it's nothing against them. They just, they don't have access to it and all that. And so we need more communication of this stuff, more dissemination. And I think that's where it all is. I mean, what's the point of doing all this when all this science went? No one knows about it, right? And no one can learn from it and apply it. And so, I believe in that. Everything going into a research study is like, eventually I want to be able to communicate this with the public, society, and people who can benefit from it. So,
all right, so where can people find you? Instagram?
Instagram. That's it, really. I have a Twitter account, but I rarely use that thing. So I'm just focused on building these infographics on Instagram at Dr. Eddie Joe. And I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know. I just did it for fun, and it's just kind of like, gaining some speed. And so I
think you should make a coffee table book. Yeah.
The doctor,
I think it'd be really good.
Doctor has a period after it.
I think so. Yeah, it does.
DR period.
Yeah, DR period, Eddie Joe. Yeah. And, I get some DMs asking, can I get a print? And I was like,
you're in the poster business.
Dude, they were like, I want to hang out in my gym. Real. And I'm like, you want to pay me for this? And I was like, well, yeah. And so I had to come up with the number.
free downloads. We were in, dude.
And so I didn't imagine that to ever, I didn't ever imagine anybody asking me if they can print it out and all that.
How many infographics do you have at the moment?
I don't know.
Dozens, hundreds?
No, probably like 30 50. Or something like that. I just started this.
Dude, you gotta make a book.
Yeah, just make a book.
That's enough for the book.
Coffee table book. It'd be dope. Man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll, maybe.
I'll
who
buy,
knows?
I'll buy one. Dude, I'll totally buy one. I'll probably ask you for free, but I would buy one.
I was thinking free, but okay.
I'm thinking a hookup.
As soon as the party's over at your house, I wish all these people would go home. Hey, you guys want to get into some lactate threshold? Look at this.
Yeah, man.
Coffee table book for gyms, man.
100 pages of lactate threshold infographics here.
Oh, yeah. Let's keep it going.
If every gym had that in the lounge area, that'd be great.
Oh, man.
So if somebody was interested in being a student of yours at school, where do they go?
Cal Poly Pomona. I mean, our website's not really, that fancy, but you could always look us up. Cal Poly Pomona, the kinesiology department. I'm in the exercise science part of it. And you can look up the Human Performance Research Lab over at Cal Poly and Cal Poly Pomona. That is not Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And then there's some information up there. You can go on PubMed if you want, PubMed.com, look up the research studies if you want to read some of the stuff that we do in our lab. But, it's a productive lab, man. I got some great students. Shout out to my grad students and also my undergrad research assistants. They're just pumping out research, and I'm so open-minded too. I don't want to be too narrow focused on my research and just focus on one single thing. And I like to open it up. I like to appease their interest and say, let's take this question to the lab. We'll be just having a discussion, say, let's go to the lab and test it out. Let's do a little case study. Let's just see what happens, right? And that sometimes leads into bigger questions, and that leads into a bigger study. And so right now we're just doing fun stuff. Like, they're doing a glute study. I guess they're inspired by the glute guy, and they saw some of his studies. They're like, can we do something like that? And I was like, you want to do something like that? And they're like, yeah. I was like, well, I got some EMG. I got some stuff that we can analyze and used to analyze. And I was like, let's create a study. So we just do it, and we're doing that right now.
EMG on the ass. That's where it's at.
We're not curing cancer or anything like that with this research, but it's just fun stuff, And, we got the ketone study. I do a lot of sports supplement studies and some training studies and things of that sort. And so, if you come and you connect with me, I can get you involved. I never turn away a student, unless, obviously their records don't allow them to get into the school.
I won't, but the school may.
Yeah.
If I want to be a lab rat?
Oh, yeah, just come
on. You're looking for more lab rats, right?
All the time, man. Perfect. So if you hit me up, shoot me an email or DM me on Instagram or whatever, and, we could get you set up as long as you meet the criteria, man.
The DMs, man. Yeah, the DMs is out of fucking control.
I know it is out of control, man. But, it's fun. It's a fun job, man. Awesome. Just talk about the stuff that I love and, you know, do the research.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Yeah. Anders, where can people find what you're doing?
Come to movement-rx.com. We are Dr. Teresa and I, physical therapists, and myself writing strength and rehab programs, shoulders, low back, knee. Come and hang out with us. Gym owners, functional fitness athletes. Come get healthy. Learn how to move better.
Boom.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And we did a couple shows, you know, one show focusing on the low back fix, one show focusing on the knee fix, one show yes. focusing on the shoulder fix. So
check
if you want more
out.
Details about any of those programs, we have full episodes on each one of those yes. that were very, very good with you and Teresa.
Yes.
Yep. Check those out. For me, go to DougLarsonFitness.com. Talking with a bunch of people right now about doing some seminars later this year. Been talking with Anders, been talking with Andy Galpin, been talking with Travis Mash, been talking with Aaron Horsig over at Squat University, talking with tons of smart people about doing some live in-person stuff, which I'm really excited about for this year. So if you're interested in that, you can go to DougLarsonFitness.com. Also, I'm on Instagram at Douglas E. Larson.
Oh.
Yep.
And if you want to find more of what I'm up to, check out TheBledsoeShow.com. I'm committed to 10,000 interviews before I die. So that's 5 a week for the next 40 years at least. I'm going to be diving into some interesting subjects. I think you'll like it. Check it out. And I'll be traveling around this year a bit. If you go over there, you'll be able to see where I'm going to be. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can meet up.
I'm super looking out. Forward to Mike Bledsoe interview at like 68 years old.
Yeah.
What are you going to be talking about at 60?
There's really no time. Because if you would have told me what I'd be talking about today, 5 years ago, yeah. I would have been like, no fucking
it's
way.
It's got to grow.
It's got to grow.
Everything has to grow.
Yeah, who knows? I'll be probably 68. I'll be doing the show from Mars or some shit. It's going to be great. Yeah. All right, go over to iTunes. Give us a 5-star review, positive comment. Hit YouTube. Subscribe. Do it. See you next week.
Thanks for making it all the way to the end of the show. If you liked the show, which I know you did, please go share it on Facebook, Instagram, or whatever social media channel you happen to be loving at the moment. Pinterest, Twitter?
Tumblr.
Share it on Tumblr.